This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
Stand up for Senator Booker and Trevor Noah!
All right. So, Trevor and I aren't talking tonight. We're actually going to be singing duets. No, I'm so pleased to see everybody here tonight. And I made a confession when I walked in to see Trevor that I would not have read his book with all that's going on, but it ended up being something that I didn't love, was not the right word. I cherish this. I cherish it. It was a gift to me during some really tough days over this last week and helped to deepen me to this understanding of the idea of struggle. And I think it's something that's remarkable. And I really hope that you'll read this book. I hope you'll buy extra copies, because I do think this is something you give away. My family is literally sitting here. I'm buying at the end of the night copies for them, because it's really an unexpected gift. The second thing I want to say before I ask you my first question is that it was very unexpected. I have a friend that knows you really well, and we were both texting back and forth like, we had no idea. We see you on The Daily Show. We just figure, here's a black guy from South Africa, got on The Daily Show, and wow. But this book is an odyssey that I never could have imagined. And you wrote with such unflinching courage and honesty, coupled with your wit. But it is a kind of humor that, strangely, I felt like I grew up with, in the sense of listening to Richard Pryor or the comedians that healed my father, it seemed. A humor that recognized the wretchedness of the world, but helped us cope better. Why did you write it in the first place? Why was it important to you to write this book?
Well, first of all, thank you for reading it, and thank you, everybody, for being here with me. The biggest reason I wrote the book was just because of it was friends, it was family, it was everyone I told stories to who said to me, have you ever said that on stage? I would tell a story, and someone would say, have you ever told that story? And I'd say, no. You know, and I never believed that sharing my stories, which seemed so unique, would ever connect with anybody. I never realized how in specificity you could achieve themes that were as broad as they are in the book. I would have never thought that my suffering in a township in South Africa could connect with your suffering all the way across the world on another continent. You know, I never thought that stories of domestic abuse that I went through and my mother endured were things that would connect with people in places all over the world. But when I wrote it, I wrote it to share. I wrote it for two reasons. One, for myself as a cathartic experience. You know, I do realize that I did not live the easiest life. And the second reason was I wrote it to share and connect with people. Genuinely, a lot of people, and I understand, had no clue where I had come from. People just saw this random human being who popped up on The Daily Show, and, you know, and Jon Stewart's sanity was questioned, and and really, I could understand, because for people, they're like, who the hell are you? You're wearing a suit, you look like you've lived a wonderful life, why the hell should we listen to anything you say, or who are you to even talk to us or with us? And I realized that, as you do in any friendship, what you do to connect with a person is you tell them your stories. And, you know, my stand-up comedy audiences know me through my stories, and I thought, well, if there are people who are willing to read the book, then hopefully they can get to know me and we can get to know each other better through the stories I tell here.
But as I'm reading it, lots of people tell their stories, but you have this unflinching honesty in it. And literally there were moments where my lawyer hat came on, and I'm like, okay, thank God, I think the statute of limitations has expired on this. I don't think that we're going to have to extradite him. Well, maybe if they ask for extradition, I'll fight it. I'll use my Senate seat. We will not give up Trevor.
Thank you so much. No, you know what? It is a tall order. When you start writing a book, when you start telling your stories, you come to realize the Herculean task that's ahead of you, and that is unflinching honesty. And I sat down with my editor, and the question was, how honest do I want to be? And I realized if I write the book and I'm not completely honest, then there will always be these hidden mines that I'm hoping not to provoke as I talk about the book or as I share the stories with people. Someone may not understand a story because I did not tell the truth about how it came to be or how I ended up in that position, because I'm trying to gloss over my life. I'm trying to make myself look better than I am, or trying to make my world seem slightly more polished than it is. And it's just easier. It's easier. You know, judge me if you want to judge me, but I think if we're honest about our stories with each other, and that was really something that I got from my mom. One of the greatest gifts was her saying to me, we share these things and we share them honestly. And she was referring to domestic abuse. And she said, because so many people in a community, so many women are hiding the story, sitting next to somebody who has the exact same thing happening to them, and everyone is glossing over it. Everyone is masquerading because they don't want to be the one who's seen as weak, not realizing that everybody that you are talking to may be going through the same thing.
So I want to start there and maybe even end there in my questions before we get to a lot of the folks here who've been so kind to write things down. And I want to encourage everybody, we won't stick to just these. I want them to continue to run questions up. If you all have things, please write them down. And in the name of unflinching honesty, ask your honest questions. He can ignore them if he wants, but ask them anyway. I do think it's the Born a Crime subtitle of the book is like, where did that come from? And I want to get to that. And so could you actually pick up the book, and would you be willing to read, starting on page 27, where it says, where most children are proof? And while he's looking for that, I want you to know, I've got the book here, and I've also listened to the book as well. Because I think having both for me was a gift. Because you first of all, I couldn't pronounce the clausa.
Oh, that's good.
Thank you very much.
Oh, that's actually pretty good.
I've listened to you do it now for like 10 hours.
That's really impressive. That's really impressive.
But your accents, the way you take on other characters in the book.
Thank you very much.
Especially the thing that would make me smile the most is when you are the little you. But why don't you read this for me?
All right. Where most children are proof of their parents' love, I was the proof of their criminality. The only time I could be with my father was indoors. If we left the house, he'd have to walk across the street from us. My mom and I used to go to Jubeir Park all the time. It's the central park of Johannesburg. Beautiful gardens, a zoo, a giant chessboard with human-sized pieces that people would play. My mother tells me that once, when I was a toddler, my dad tried to go with us. We were in the park. He was walking a good bit away from us. And I ran after him, screaming, Daddy, Daddy, Daddy. People started looking. He panicked and ran away. I thought it was a game and kept chasing him. I couldn't walk with my mother either. A light-skinned child with a black woman would raise too many questions. When I was a newborn, she could wrap me up and take me anywhere. But very quickly, that was no longer an option. You see, I was a giant baby. Mm-hmm. An enormous child. When I was one, you would have thought I was two. When I was two, you'd have thought I was four. There was no way to hide me. My mom, same as she'd done with her flat and with her maid's uniforms, found the cracks in the system. It was illegal to be mixed. In other words, to have a black parent and a white parent. But it was not illegal to be colored. In other words, to have two parents who were both colored. So my mom moved me around the world as a colored child. She found a creche in a colored area where she could leave me while she was at work. There was a colored woman named Queen who lived in our block of flats. When we wanted to go out to the park, my mom would invite her to go with us. Queen would walk next to me and act like she was my mother. And my mother would walk a few steps behind like she was the maid working for the colored woman. I've got dozens of pictures of me walking with this woman who looks exactly like me, but who isn't my mother. And the black woman standing behind us who looks like she's photobombing the picture, that's my mom. When we didn't have a colored woman to walk with us, my mom would risk walking me on her own. She would hold my hand or carry me, but if the police showed up, she would have to drop me and pretend I wasn't hers. I felt like I was a bag of weed.
So there's a whole bunch of powerful dynamics that are in there, and one, I just want to make it clear, in South Africa, there are black communities.
Yes.
There are colored communities, which are people that look like you and I, that look like they're mixed
yes.
descent. And then there are white communities. And then there are a whole lot of other confusing folks who they had to try to figure out a way to warp their laws So I chuckled at a funny part where you were like, their Chinese were considered black.
And Japanese people were considered white.
Right, and you were saying that a police officer could see some guy on a park bench and come over to them and be like, you're black, you can't sit there. And he goes, no, I'm Japanese. And
Look, the truth is, apartheid was a ridiculous system. Racism is a ridiculous thing when you think about it, because it is artificial, it's a construct. But it's simple. And a lot of the time, a lot of stupid ideas are exactly that. They are simple, and that is why they work so well in terms of convincing people to continue subscribing to them. But in South Africa, because you had a situation where 6% of the population was in power, and they were trying to control the remaining 94%, how do you go about doing that? That's a Herculean task. So the South African government sets out to create the most perfect form of racism, the most perfect form of oppression and segregation. And they went out to all the countries where they thought they could find the right information. They went to Australia, they went to the Netherlands, they came to the United States, and they searched for all types of racisms, and they wanted to seek out what was the best way to oppress a group of people. And they found cracks in all the different systems, and they worked to patch that software, essentially. And one of the things they found, and that was almost a weakness in America, was in America you had the one-drop rule. So if you were a person who had a drop of black blood in you, you were black. In South Africa, they couldn't allow the same metric because that meant you would now be a black person who is added to the majority, and the majority increasing was not something they wanted. So instead, what they set out to do was, they said if you were a person who was black and then you were also half white, they would then recategorize you as a new race, and that race they called colored. And so colored people who were born of mixed parents were taken away from their families. And over time, as insane as it sounds, an entire race grew from this, an entire community grew from this. Generations of people who essentially look mixed race, but have no parents of either race. So their parents are mixed, as in colored, but then it's colored, 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 generation to generation. And they don't even live as black or white, have their own dialect, their own culture. And that was the power of apartheid.
But that's what made you such, and forgive me for using this word, but an oddity, if I can use that word. And it's because, first of all, your mom, who I don't want to lose how courageous she is, and the next thing I want you to read sort of reflects maybe a little of this, but your mom made this conscious decision with this European man who didn't want to have kids, but convince him to have you, and now you are, many children like this that are born from such people that have a child are taken away to orphanages.
Yes.
But your mom decides to keep you, so she's not safe with you in black communities where you stick out and people could snitch on you. They're not safe with you in white communities where you stick out and there could be problems. Like, she risks, especially in your early childhood, when you had a tendency to run a lot.
Yes,
I say that to him because I
enjoyed running.
Yes. I wanted my mom to read this book also because I was a bad child. But when I read this book, I thought my mom would look and say, well, thank God you weren't that bad.
throwing me under the bus.
Yes, I am. I'm still working after 40 years to get back in my mom's good graces. So you created a layers and layers of complexity, not just for your mother, who was trying to raise you, but you also created or came up in an environment where none of those communities accepted you as theirs.
I mean, that was the biggest thing that I had to deal with. And, you know, I was lucky in that my mom was always an outsider in her own right. So I looked to her as my mentor, in essence, in terms of learning how to live in a space that treats you as an outsider, treats you as someone who does not belong. But you can imagine, I grew up in a world where everywhere I went, I was an outsider. We lived in Soweto, which was a black community. And I mean black across the board. There were no light-skinned people. There were no white people. Soweto was completely black. I was the only person who looked like this in my entire neighborhood, you know, for miles and miles. People knew of me because of my skin color. It was almost like a myth for some people, you know. And when we went to a white neighborhood, then I would stick out. And when I was in a colored neighborhood, ironically, that was one of the places where I would feel the most backlash, was because I looked exactly like the people, but I wasn't of them. because I wasn't like them culturally. I didn't have the same accent. I didn't speak the same language. And that's when I came to learn that sometimes in life, it's easier to be an insider as an outsider than it is to be an outsider as an insider. You know, and that is when you are in a community where you do not subscribe to the norms of that community, sometimes your own people will be the quickest to lash out at you and lambast you for shunning or what they believe. You know, they believe that you are shunning everything that you appear to be. And so that was something that I learned very early on, and that was pretty much what predicated the rest of my life.
And you write about that in beautiful prose. I can't wait till everybody here gets to read to you in wonderful detail about talking about that. And I did find parallels within the American society. But I want to get to this. Your mother is your partner. She's your role model. But you guys have this dynamic that is so fascinating to me. And how you guys coped with this warped, disturbed world was fascinating. And I want to talk about two of those types of coping mechanisms. So your mom is this strong woman. You and I both were talking about how we said black women mothers, I'm sure some other ethnicities can relate to this. They're going to beat you or put you into your place so you understand, so you don't do things that endanger your own life.
Yeah, my mom always said, she said, I will kill you before the world kills you. My mom always said that. She said, I'm not going to let you go out there and let the police kill you. I'm not going to go out there and let the world. She said, the world is coming for you. So she said, I will be the one who takes you out of it. She said, I brought you into this world and I will take you out of it. But I will not stand by and say I didn't do everything I could to make sure that you understood the difference between right and wrong.
But open to page 9, because one of the other coping mechanisms, which is deep within the African-American tradition, is that your mom had a profound allegiance to a white man named Jesus. And her deep, at the bottom of the page.
Well, he wasn't really white, but anyway.
I said, hey. As we speak about this in a synagogue. Okay. start with at the very bottom of the page, my mother, and end with the word spanking, please.
Where are we, page?
Page 9 at the very bottom. My mother is as stubborn.
Got it. Okay. My mother is as stubborn as she is religious. Once her mind's made up, that's it. Indeed, obstacles that would normally lead a person to change their plans, like a car breaking down, only made her more determined to forge ahead. It's the devil, she said about the stalled car. The devil doesn't want us to go to church. That's why we've got to catch minibuses. Whenever I found myself up against my mother's faith obstinacy, I would try as respectfully as possible to counter with an opposing point of view. Or, I said, the Lord knows that today we shouldn't go to church, which is why he made sure the car wouldn't start, so that we stay at home as a family and take a day of rest, because even the Lord rested. Ah, that's the devil talking, Trevor. No, because Jesus is in control. And if Jesus is in control and we pray to Jesus, he would let the car start. But he hasn't, therefore... No, Trevor, sometimes Jesus puts obstacles in your way to see if you overcome them. Like Job, this could be a test. Ah, yes, Mom, but the test could be to see if we're willing to accept what has happened and stay at home and praise Jesus for his wisdom. No. That's the devil talking. Now go change your clothes. But Mom, Trevor, sunkhela is a phrase with many shades of meaning. It says, don't undermine me, don't underestimate me, and just try me. It's a command and a threat all at once. It's a common thing for Xhosa parents to say to their kids. Anytime I heard it, I knew it meant the conversation was over. And if I muttered another word, I was in for a hiding, basically what we call a spanking.
So, by the way, my mom didn't have that class of words. She just had to look. this banter between you and your mom goes on littered throughout the book.
Yes.
Even to the point where you're adults, and after an ending which stunned me that I'm not going to tell people about, even then you almost had a debate about what God's intention was. But your mom used religion as a coping mechanism, and it helped to ground her. Is that right?
Definitely. I think my mom used religion in the way I feel we should all use religion. And that is, she used it as a guide. She used it as a roadmap. She used it as a place of solace. You know, oftentimes I get brokenhearted when people use religion as a tool to oppress other people, as opposed to using religion as a space where you can exist and find your answers. My mom is a deeply religious woman who, at a time that was trying in her life, found religion and continued, to find religion. She became a scholar of the Bible, and later on in my life, you know, she got really wrapped up and converted to Judaism. And we lived in this world where religion was all I knew. My mom was always searching for answers. She was always searching for scriptures that would give her enlightenment. And I mean, as a kid, I didn't appreciate it because all that meant was more church. You know, I went to church 3 or 4 times every single Sunday. In a week, we were going to church in some way, shape, or form. Maybe.
And they were very different
times.
Churches, right?
Yeah, every church was different. We started off, we would go to, there was like a multiracial church that we went to, which was like a pop Christian rock church, you know, the ones with the karaoke screens and the rock band playing. And we would go to like a very, you know, orthodox, like a white church with very calm and, you know, singing the, you know, all things bright and beautiful, like those types of churches. And then we would always end the day at Black Church. And that was like in the township. It would be like tent style, evangelical. And it just, like, it never ended. It never. Black Church takes so, like, if you've ever been to Black Church, you're probably still there now. Like, you know what I'm talking about. Black Church, it takes forever. And as a kid, I always used to think to myself, I used to sit there and I would go, the only thing I could think of was, Black people just need more time with Jesus because things are really not going well. You know, white people just come to check in and leave, and then black people would, they would be like, no, we need another thing and another thing and another thing. But that's where we found more than just answers. We also found community.
Yes.
And that was the wonderful thing about a church, was that, you know, a church was a space where a new tribe was created that existed beyond race, a new tribe that existed beyond class. It was a space where everyone was searching out for the same thing, and everyone was governed by the same laws and in agreement. And that's basically how we lived our lives. And, you know, my mom, at a certain age, wasn't as pressing on me in terms of, you know, being as religious as she wanted me to be. And that's where, like, when I tell people the stories of Judaism, like, that came out of nowhere in my world, because one day my mom just decided, she said, I can't, she had read the Bible, I think 20, 30, maybe in 40 times, and she said, I need more. And then, you know, she found out that the scriptures had been converted, and she said, I want to learn, and she started learning Hebrew, and she said, I want to read more scriptures. And then I come home in my world, and then my mom is saying, like, things to me like, Baruch Hashem Adonai, and I'm sitting there, I'm like, I don't know what's going on right now. And then she's telling me that I've got a bar mitzvah, and I don't know what this is. And so,
was there a circumcision at all in there?
No, I was circumcised because my mom was in religion, so I was circumcised as a child. Like, we lived like that. And when I turned 13, my mom was like, "Okay, you're a man. We're gonna give you a bar mitzvah." And you gotta understand, I only have black family members. You know, my dad's Swiss and his family's in Switzerland. So she said this, and then she said, "You've got a bar mitzvah," and nobody came because nobody knew what this thing was. And my mom just said to me, "You're now a man," and then she gave me a little bit of money, and she was like, "Okay, that's." And I was like, "I don't know what just happened in this world. All I know is now I'm saying Shana Tova, and now." But that's really, religion was a family that we could claim that we never had, and that's really a really great role that it played in our lives.
But so this is your mom's coping mechanism, and obviously it had a deep effect on you as well. Yashar Koach, but I watched through your prose, sort of two other coping mechanisms that you had to develop, because this is not just the toughness of the race line that you were dealing with. You were dealing with the toughness of and not also the domestic violence, but you were also dealing with the toughness of poverty. I mean, just the things you were forced to eat from, I mean, the caterpillar.
Yes,
thank you
very
much.
Why is it sticking on your tongue? You can't even say it? Is that how bad it is?
I'm telling you.
That's how it feels on your tongue, by the way, when you're trying to eat it. That's exactly what happens.
Yeah, I almost want to tell you, I almost want to mark those pages for you so you know to read them really quickly. Or, again, I'm a vegan, so this is really difficult. But you're like the smileys, I guess the
goat's head,
the goat's head, yeah, and the descriptions of the eyeballs that you had.
Yes,
to eat.
Yes. But you know, that was one of those things where when people who read the book, the one thing I always feel when they meet me after the book, they go, "I didn't know you had such a tough life, and I'm so sorry." And I honestly tell people, I say, I acknowledge that there were moments of toughness, and I realize that we went through a really rough period. But I always hope people don't think, I do not tell those stories in any way trying to elicit sympathy, because if anything, I was just trying to paint a picture of the world that I, and more importantly, we lived in. This was the black experience in South Africa. This wasn't my experience. This wasn't something that I was doing on my own. Many families were eating caterpillars around me.
This is the point I'm trying to make. So I love the way you talk about things in a way that the same scene that you paint would have, an American would find objectionable. Like, I didn't know cats were such dangerous critters.
You mean in terms of witchcraft?
Yes, I didn't know the whole witchcraft.
Yeah, you
can't
have cats in Africa.
No, you told this wonderful story about a soccer game and a cat got on the field, which must have been a witch trying to hex one of the teams.
Yep.
And the African man goes out there and does what he should have done, and according to custom.
Yeah, according to his culture, yeah.
Yes, just kill the cat right there in front of everybody. But then the Western audience, seeing this, a guy ends up getting brought up on animal cruelty charges. So I understand, and that's one of the powerful parts of the book, but you chose two dynamics of coping that could have gone either way, and I've seen people go different ways. So one of the ways of coping, some people give up. Like, I'm reading Hillbilly Elegy right now, which is a book of a lot where he talks very objectively about people deciding not to get into the hustle. But some people decide to dig in and they become ridiculous in their creative work ethic. And in many ways, that might have led to your professional career. But there's this wonderful moment that I'm going to have you read now on page 139. And I just want to set the scene for everybody, because you are constantly getting in trouble in school. And again, I can't wait till my mom reads this, because you are just like getting detention all the time. And you're not fitting into the groups. You have this beautiful moment on the playground where you literally everybody's separating into their different parts, but you don't know what to do. But then you use this creative drive of yours and hustle. And so at the very bottom of that page, 139, start with immediately and then lead to the end of the chapter, because this shows how you coped.
Okay.
Then immediately.
So this is my life stories. I guess this is really the school years. Then immediately after assembly, there would be a race to the tuck shop, our cafeteria, because the queue to buy food was so long. Every minute you spent in the queue was working against your break time. The sooner you got your food, the longer you had to eat, play a game of soccer, or hang out. Also, if you got there late, the best food was gone. Two things were true about me at that age. One, I was still the fastest kid in the school. And two, I had no pride. The second, we were dismissed from assembly. I would run like a bat out of hell to the tuck shop so I could be the first one there. And I was always the first in line. I became notorious for being that guy, so much so that people started coming up to me in line. "Hey, Trevor, can you buy this for me?" Which would piss off the kids behind me, because it was basically cutting the line. So people started approaching me during assembly. They'd say, "Hey, I've got 10 rand. If you buy my food for me, I'll give you 2. That's when I learned, time is money. I realized people would pay me to buy their food because I was willing to run for it. I started telling everyone at assembly, "Place your orders, give me a list of what you want, give me a percentage of what you're going to spend, and I'll buy your food for you." I was an overnight success. Fat guys were my number one customers. They loved food but couldn't run. I had all these rich, fat, white kids who were like, "This is fantastic. My parents spoil me, I've got money, and now I've got a way I can get food without having to work for it. And I still get my break." I had so many customers, I was turning kids away. I had a rule. I would take 5 orders a day, high bidders only. I'd make so much that I could buy my lunch using other kids' money and keep the lunch money my mom gave me for pocket cash. Then I could afford to catch a bus home instead of walking, or save up to buy whatever. Every day I'd take orders. Assembly would end, and I'd make my mad dash and buy everybody's hot dogs and Cokes and muffins. If you paid me extra, you could even tell me where you'd be and I'd deliver it to you. I'd found my niche. Since I belonged to no group, I learned to move seamlessly between groups. I floated. I was a chameleon. Still, a cultural chameleon. I learned how to blend. I could play sports with the jocks. I could talk computers with the nerds. I could jump in the circle and dance with the township kids. I popped around to everyone, working, chatting, telling jokes, making deliveries. I was like a weed dealer, but of food. The weed guy is always welcome at the party. He's not part of the circle, but he's invited into the circle temporarily because of what he can offer. And that's who I was. Always an outsider. As the outsider, you can retreat into a shell, be anonymous, be invisible. Or you can go the other way. You protect yourself by opening up. You don't ask to be accepted for everything you are, just the one part of yourself that you're willing to share. For me, it was humor. I learned that even though I didn't belong to one group, I could be a part of any group that was laughing. I'd drop in, pass out the snacks, tell a few jokes. I'd perform for them. I'd catch a bit of their conversation, learn more about their group, and then leave. I never overstayed my welcome. I wasn't popular, but I wasn't an outcast. I was everywhere with everybody, and at the same time, I was all by myself.
That's powerful. And so, in a sense, in this world that you were born into of a delusion of race, with people that you saw buy into that in tough ways, somehow, not only did it motivate in you a spirit of working really hard, and we'll get a little bit more into that, but to me, it also gave you this powerful sense to identify with others, which I think is empathy, the ability to see and understand other groups. And I want to shift really quickly to just driving that empathy home, because there's this understanding that hurt people often hurt people.
Yes.
And they carry scars with them. But then there are folks like you who, you read this book, clearly you went through your toughness and got hurt, but something happened in you that it spawned a love. And this is a moment that to me was chilling. This is a very scary moment for me when I read this passage. But what you saw in the midst of your tears and the crisis, what you saw is really powerful to me. And so let me just say this. We said that your own group, and I shouldn't say your group, but the people that look like you and me, the coloreds, mm-hmm. were some of the harshest to you.
Yes.
And you're a little boy, and you go, and I'm on page 124. You're a little boy, and you go to pick mulberries off of the mulberry tree. And you're excited about the fruit that you have. And you encounter a bunch of colored boys who, again, the harshest experience. And what I think is powerful about this passage, and I want you to go from the middle of that page, Abel wasn't laughing, all the way down to the end of, but I knew I'd done a terrible thing, which is on 125, but just about one full page of reading. But I want to just put this to the abuser in the house, who was your mom's stepdad.
He was living with us on and off at the time. And on this particular day, I had just been bullied by the kids. We were living in a colored area. And around that season, kids would pick mulberries off a mulberry tree, and I was picking them with them. And the kids just decided to, just turn on me and started bullying me and beating me with, hitting me with mulberries and cursing me out.
Yes.
And this is the story of when I came home and told my parents, well, my mom, and then my stepdad.
Right.
The story.
And just as a side about your mother, and I've had this childhood reaction when you go home to your mother and you want her to be upset, but your mom laughed.
Yeah.
And she laughed because at first she thought you were covered with blood, and then she realized it was
mulberry juice.
Mulberry juice.
Yes.
So now she's not taking you seriously, but she says something really sweet. She goes, "You're hurt on the inside, but you're not hurt on the outside, so I'm okay."
Yeah.
And then Abel comes home, this scary big man. And why don't you take it from there? What happens?
So you want me to go from Abel was laughing to where?
Abel wasn't laughing to right here. I've done
okay,
a terrible thing.
It. Abel wasn't laughing. As I told him what the bullies had done, I could see the anger building up inside him. With Abel's anger, there was no ranting and raving, no clenched fists. He sat there on the couch listening to me, not saying a word. Then, very calm and deliberate, he stood up. "Take me to these boys," he said. Yes, I thought, this is it. Big brother is going to get my revenge for me. We got into his car and drove up the road, stopping a few houses down from the tree. It was dark now except for the light from the street lamps, but we could see the boys were still there playing under the tree. I pointed to the ringleader. That's the one. He was the main one. Abel slammed his foot on the gas and shot up onto the grass and straight toward the bottom of the tree. He jumped out. I jumped out. As soon as the kids saw me, they knew exactly what was happening. They scattered and ran like hell. Abel was quick. Good Lord, he was fast. The ringleader had made a dash for it and was trying to climb over a wall. Abel grabbed him, pulled him down, and dragged him back. Then he stripped a branch off the tree, a switch, and started whipping him. He whipped the shit out of him, and I loved it. I've never enjoyed anything as much as I enjoyed that moment. Revenge truly is sweet. It takes you to a dark place, but man, it satisfies a thirst. Then there was the strangest moment where it flipped. I caught a glimpse of the look of terror in the boy's face, and I realized that Abel had gone past getting revenge for me. He wasn't doing this to teach the kid a lesson. He was just beating him. He was a grown man, venting his rage on a 12-year-old boy. In an instant, I went from, yes, I got my revenge, to no, 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 too much, shit, 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 dear God, what have I done? Once this kid was beat to shit, Abel dragged him over to the car and held him up in front of me. Say you're sorry. The kid was whimpering, trembling. He looked me in the eye, and I'd never seen fear in someone's eyes like I saw in his. He'd been beaten by a stranger in a way I don't think he'd ever been beaten before. He said he was sorry. But it was like his apology wasn't for what he'd done to me. It was like he was sorry for every bad thing he'd ever done in his life, because he didn't know there could be a punishment like this. Looking in that boy's eyes, I realized how much he and I had in common. He was a kid. I was a kid. He was crying. I was crying. He was a colored boy in South Africa, taught how to hate and how to hate himself. Who had bullied him that he needed to bully me? He'd made me feel fear, and to get my revenge, I'd unleashed my own hell on his world. But I knew I'd done a terrible thing.
And so that moment of empathy to me, I read that and it was just so powerful, because it's a step that not everybody can get to, who go through pain. And these kids went from literally relentlessly beating you to moments later you seeing your common humanity, your oneness with them. And do you think, growing up, what you did, and I think about this in communities which I live and work, that you see people who sometimes get so caught up, they become the very demon that they often experienced.
Most definitely. And I think that is probably the most difficult thing for us to combat in ourselves, is the need for revenge. You know, oftentimes people mistake justice and revenge. It is hard, and I mean, you look at America right now, to be in a place where people are asked to have empathy for those who seem to have voted against the majority's best interests. You know, how do you ask black people in America to empathize with their oppressors? And it is extremely difficult. Most of the time we are not capable of it. But I grew up in a country where it was necessary. And I learned it from my mom. And I think we were lucky to be in a country where we had Nelson Mandela, who exhibited that. You know, it was Barack Obama who had a very beautiful phrase, you know, just after Nelson Mandela's funeral, where he said, Nelson Mandela taught me that you could free not only the prisoner, but also the guard. And that was a powerful moment that I realized I had understood early on in my life. And that was oftentimes the person that was hurting you or oppressing you themselves was oppressed and hurt, even though they didn't seem to be. And in your need for revenge, the cycle would never break. I would go after that person, they would come after me, they would come after me, go after them. I mean, it's the story of gang violence, both in America and in South Africa. It's the reason it never ends. Everything is revenge for what happened. There is no one who says it stops. And so because it doesn't stop, everybody dies. And this moment for me was one where I had to look into the eyes of the person who I was getting my revenge on. And maybe that was it. Maybe that was that moment where I saw a human being on the other side of my revenge, which oftentimes we don't. And I realized that I didn't want to be responsible for that. I didn't want to live in a world where I was making people feel like that. That wasn't me winning. That was us losing, but me giving them what they gave me, which means now you had two hurt people, as opposed to one hurt person who was trying to heal and another person who needed to be enlightened.
And I'm not sure if you knew, you consciously put this into your book, but your spirit is in this book. Even when you talk about police officers, I love how you joke about the police officers in the book about how in America they go through the ruse. Why did you pull me over, officer? Well, you were going a little bit over the speed limit. Well, you know you pulled me over because I'm a black man.
Yes.
I'm running the wrong neighborhood. But you're like, in South Africa, they don't even bother with that.
Yeah, that's what I enjoy about South Africa. People often ask me, they go, what's the big differences you find between America and South Africa? There are a lot of mirror images between us as nations, you know, nations that have histories of colonization and, you know, histories of oppression and racial segregation. One of the biggest advantages I feel we have in South Africa is there isn't the facade. You know, nobody denies it. We know that the racism is there. We had to go through a Truth and Reconciliation Commission where we all had to acknowledge it. And even that was a beautiful thing that gave people a sense of justice, because no longer, you know, you couldn't live in a world where people made you feel like you were mad. You know, in America, still there's people going, racism's gone, that's not a thing. You know, was slavery even that bad? To have those conversations is ridiculous. And we still have that. We had that growing up. You know, the police didn't lie to us. I've constantly been shocked when I've been pulled over in the U.S. where policemen, like, just ask me questions. I remember I got pulled over once. I was driving outside. I was up New York, upstate. And I got pulled over, and the policeman said, sir, do you know why I pulled you over? And I turned to him, and I didn't even realize, because we have a very different relationship with our police. And I said, no. I said, I'm not in your mind. How would I know that? He said, no. What do you mean, do I know why you pulled me over? No, I don't. You know, and you could see he had never heard that response. But I had never heard a person say that. Why would I know why you pulled me over? But the facade of everything, like him trying to act like there was some other reason for him. And then my friend said to me, hey, man, if you're a black guy driving a nice car, you're going to get pulled over. This is how it works, and this is the world that we live in. Back home, the policeman would just tell you. The guy would pull you over, and then he would just go, hey, what are you blackies doing here? You know? And we'd be like, oh, you're just driving around, officer. And he'd be like, you got any drugs? And be like, no. You got any guns? No. And be like, all right, get out of here, go. But it was just like, it sounds strange, but it's easier to heal when there is brutal honesty than when people act like it's not there.
And so you write in a way that you expose this stuff, but you also show even an empathy for the police officer. At one point, you're like, they have a job as well. You know, they're caught in this thing. But I wanted this last reading I want you to do, because there's one figure in your book that even I, when I saw you in the back, it's just hard for me in this country of America, and seeing this through your eyes in South Africa, knowing that we live in a nation with a culture that makes rape more prevalent, a culture of sexual abuse and physical violence against women that is at levels that most Americans don't want to face and don't want to see. And so on page 254, I want you to just, and this will be the last one, then we'll get to some questions. But this was very important for me, because you point out the utter hypocrisy, the trap of sexual violence, of domestic violence, of assault. And you as a child experiencing this. So can you just start here at late one night?
Okay.
The house filled up with smoke. And this is basically... I'm sorry. And then go right over to... then go right to the bottom. End at the bottom of this page here, of 256.
Come back in the morning.
Yes.
All right.
And then, but the one thing I want to, just as a backstory to set the story up, Abel, your stepfather, starts drinking heavily.
Yeah.
Gives up marijuana, goes to alcohol, starts drinking heavily, and he would come home, and you gave some almost comical situations where he would kick you out of your bed because he was insisting that was his bed, or he'd be urinating in a corner thinking it was a toilet, all of these things. But now he comes in, and unfortunately, very bad things happen. But why don't you start with late one night?
All right. Late one night, we woke up to a house filled with smoke. Abel hadn't come home by the time we'd gone to bed, and I'd fallen asleep in my mother's room with her and Andrew, who was still a baby. I jerked awake to her shaking me and screaming, "Trevor! Trevor!" There was smoke everywhere. We thought the house was burning down. My mom ran down the hallway to the kitchen, where she discovered the kitchen on fire. Abel had driven home drunk, blind drunk, drunker than we'd ever seen him before. He'd been hungry, tried to heat up some food on the stove, and passed out on the couch while it was cooking. The pot had burned itself out and burned up the kitchen wall behind the stove. The smoke was billowing everywhere. She turned off the stove and opened the doors and the windows to try air the place out. Then she went over to the couch and woke him up and started berating him for nearly burning the house down. He was too drunk to care. She came back into the bedroom, picked up the phone, and called my grandmother. She started going on and on about Abel and his drinking. "This man, he's going to kill us one day. He almost burnt the house down." Abel walked into the bedroom, very calm, very quiet. His eyes were blood red, his eyelids heavy. He put his finger on the cradle and hung up the call. My mom lost it. "How dare you? Don't you hang up my phone call. Who do you think you are? What do you think you're doing?"
You don't tell people what's happening in this house," he said.
"Oh, please. You worried about what the world is thinking. Worry about this world. Worry about what your family's thinking."
Abel towered over my mother. He didn't raise his voice, didn't get angry. "Mbui," he said softly, "you don't respect me."
"Respect? You almost burned down our house. Respect? Oh, please, earn your respect. You want me to respect you as a man? Then act like a man. Drinking your money in the streets? And where are your child's diapers? Respect. Earn your respect."
"Mbui.
You're not a man. You're a child."
"Mbui.
I can't have a child for a husband."
"Mbui.
I've got my own children to raise."
"Mbui, shut up."
"A man who comes home drunk."
"Mbui, shut up."
"And burns down the house."
"Mbui.
And call yourself a father."
And then out of nowhere, like a clap of thunder when there was no clouds, crack, he smacked her across the face. She ricocheted off the wall and collapsed like a ton of bricks. I'd never seen anything like it. She went down and stayed down for a good 30 seconds. Andrew, my baby brother, started screaming. I don't remember going to pick him up, but I clearly remember holding him at some point. My mom pulled herself up and struggled back to her feet and launched right back into him. She'd clearly been knocked for a loop, but she was trying to act more with it than she was. I could see the disbelief in her face. This had never happened to her before in her life. She got right back in his face and started shouting at him, "Did you just hit me?" The whole time in my head, I kept thinking the same thing. The same thing Abel was saying. "Shut up, Mom. Shut up. You're going to make it worse." Because I knew, as the receiver of many beatings, the one thing that didn't help is talking back. But she wouldn't stay quiet. "Did you just hit me?" "Mbui, I told you."
"No man has ever. Don't you think you can control me when you can't even control your..." Crack! He hit her again. She stumbled back, but this time didn't fall. She scrambled, grabbed me and grabbed Andrew. "Let's go. We're leaving." We ran out of the house and up the road. It was the dead of night, cold outside. I was wearing nothing but a t-shirt and sweatpants. We walked to the Eden Park police station over a kilometer away. My mom marched us in, and there were two cops on duty at the front desk. "I'm here to lay a charge," she said.
"What are you here to lay a charge about?"
"I'm here to lay a charge against the man who hit me." To this day, I'll never forget the patronizing, condescending way they spoke to her.
"Calm down, lady, calm down. Who hit you?"
"My husband."
"Your husband? What did you do? Did you make him angry?"
"Did I? What? No, he hit me. I'm here to lay a charge against..."
"No, no, ma'am. Why do you want to make a case, eh? You sure you want to do this? Go home and talk to your husband. You do know once you lay charges, you can't take them back. He'll have a criminal record. His life will never be the same. Do you really want your husband going to jail?"
My mom kept insisting that they take a statement and open a case, and they actually refused.
They refused to write up a charge sheet. This is a family thing, they said. You don't want to involve the police. Maybe you want to think it over and come back in the morning.
And that has a terrible consequence. The beatings continue. They're not, as you say in the book, a year might go past and then it happens. 2 years might go past, it happens again. You eventually get out of the house. But the end, and I don't want to in any way talk about the end, but except to say that it comes back in terrible consequence that the police just do nothing. It's just sort of wash it away.
That's, you know, a story that's all too familiar. It's funny, I was watching the OJ documentary Made in America, and I was shocked at the parallels even in that story. You know, how many times police got called to OJ's house, Nicole Simpson calling 911. And the thing that people forget is that police are still men. Police are still people. And unfortunately, they are subject to the same ills as their society. And one of those ills is a lack of urgency when it comes to protecting women and children. Women and children who are facing domestic abuse. And I couldn't believe it, because as a kid, that was one of the first moments I remember losing faith in the police. I had grown up enamored by police. I wanted to be a policeman as a kid. You know, what they did seemed so noble. They were the protectors. You know, they were the people who made sure that good continued. And here I was standing with my mom, who I had never seen in a weak position. And here she was, helpless, for the first time. And those people who were supposed to protect and serve us turned her away because she was causing a fuss. And that never left me, you know. And the stories, unfortunately, got worse in our lives. And it was a story that was all too familiar. My aunt was abused by her husband. My grandmother was hit by her husband, you know. And that became one of the most frightening realizations for me, is because I would hear so many people tell stories where they would go, you should leave him, you know. Oh, you always hear people saying to women, why don't you leave him? You know, why don't you go? And I remember thinking one day when listening to my mom and my grand and my aunt talk, I was like, where do you go? Where do you go when your world is a world of abuse? You know, where do you go? Do you now go into the space of being a single mother with multiple kids, and now you are seen as a whore, the woman who has no husband with these multiple children? Where do you go? And that was honestly one of the you know, it stuck with me forever. And I mean, it's the reason till this day I involve myself in as many programs as I can to try and raise awareness and fight against domestic abuse. But until it is seen as something that needs to be fought from the top down, we will always live in societies where, like in America, every 30 seconds there is a woman who is subject to domestic abuse. And it's a cycle that won't change unless we do something about it. And funny enough, it's something that men need to do something about, men with other men, sitting men down with each other and going, hey man, that doesn't make you stronger, that doesn't make you a man, that doesn't make you any more powerful in my eyes. In fact, I see you as being weak. You know, and that was just the beginning, unfortunately, for the journey that we were about to go on.
Oh, thank you for sharing that. I want to ask my last question to get to the books, but I want to read this part right now, because there's one section of the book that I felt this very kinship with, and it was with Alex, because you were describing a neighborhood, and this was like, I felt like this was like an American city. I felt a lot of kinship with parts of my city. You go through this long period of your life, your teenage years, you're moving out with your mom, you're intending to go to college, but you get caught up in the hustle and the city. And I love this, and for those who will, I feel like I'm in church, please open your Bible's page. but it's at the bottom of 219, he said, the hood has a gravitational pull. It never leaves you behind, but it also never lets you leave. Because by making the choice to leave, you're insulting the place that raised you and made you and never turned you away. And that place fights you back. As soon as things are going well for you in the hood, it's time to go, because the hood will drag you back in. It will find a way. There will be a guy who steals the thing and puts it in your car, and the cops find it. It's something. You can't stay. You think you can. You'll start doing better, and you'll bring your hood friends out to a nice nightclub, and the next thing you know, somebody starts a fight, and one of your friends pulls a gun, and somebody's getting shot, and you're left standing around going, what just happened? The hood just happened.
That's exactly what it is. It's a cycle that's unfortunate, and you know, there is always the constant dilemma. I mean, my mom and I used to fight about it all the time. I would say to my mom, you know, why leave the hood? We're supposed to stay in the hood and work to get things better. And my mom would say, but you as a young man, the hood won't let you leave. You know, as soon as you start progressing, the hood's going to suck you back in. It'll find a way. And it'll find a way to get you wrapped up in something that you shouldn't be wrapped up in. And that was really why my mom pushed me, you know, to do everything I could in life. We couldn't afford college. We really came from, you know, the humblest of beginnings, but she always fought me to search for more. And like, she said I should go hang out with my cousin at his university. And I said, but that's the same. If I'm in the hood and I'm at my cousin's university, it's the same. I'm just hanging out. And she said, no, but now you're hanging out with people who will push you to become more than you are. You will see them progressing. You will see them, you know, trying to become better. And I know you as a person, you won't allow yourself to get left behind.
And I appreciated that, because people can play by the rules, try everything like that. There's something about environments like that could trip you up, could frustrate you. And
it is difficult. But what my mom made me realize was, because she's done that, is that you almost have to get out and leave and get to a point where you've established yourself and your world enough to the point where you can come back and give back. But if you, you know, you need that incubator period almost, where you are insulated from the ills of the hood, so that when you are strong enough, you can come back and make a positive impact. And that's what my mom did. You know, she went back into a community. She's still there now, and she's given people jobs, and she's got her own, you know, she's got her own business that she runs, and she employs people in her community where she grew up, and she found a way to go back. But she always says to me, if I never left that place, it would have never left me, and I wouldn't be able to bring the world into the hood.
Right.
And that was it. And that really is the overlying theme of the book. I wrote a lot of stories from my life. I tried to coalesce as many ideas as I could. And in the end, I came to realize that I'm not the hero of my story. You know, when I wrote this book, I thought I was. I think we all think we are. But I came to realize that my mom was the hero of my story.
Clearly.
You know, I was just her punk-ass sidekick. and she truly was and continues to be a miraculous person. She's strong, she's beautiful, she's powerful. You know, she had to raise a man and still be a woman and still be the head of the household and still be more. And writing the book, honestly, when I wrote it, I thought I was just telling stories. When I looked at all of them and I started putting the pieces of the puzzle together, I came to realize that in essence it became a love letter to my mom. And I don't think I fully appreciated her growing up. I'm lucky in that we were very close, and I really did. You know, I wasn't one of those kids where I didn't care for my... I loved my mom, and she loved me. And the affection was never one that we hid. We were really, really close. But I don't think... even until I wrote the book, I was like... It went from a, wow, she's good, to like, I can't even believe I was lucky enough to share a life with this human being. And really, that's what this book has become for me.
That's incredible.
And I'm glad I got to appreciate that while she's still around.
Well, I'm glad that you shared it with us.
Please join me in welcoming Yaa Jassy to Politics and Prose.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Welcome.
If you are in the bookstore right now, please, you are in for a treat with this woman sitting right next to me. This debut novel is absolutely phenomenal. It is probably the best novel I've read in the last 5 years, and I read a lot. So this is a real treat to be sitting here next to you.
Thank you.
You're here. This is the woman. Now, please just remind us how to pronounce your name, because we all want to be able to spread the word about you and say it correctly.
So my first name is Ya, and my last name is Jesse.
Yeah, that's helpful, right? Yeah, that's helpful. Ya, Jesse.
Yes.
That's easy. We can do that. And does Ya have a meaning?
Ya is an Akan name for girl born on Thursday.
Okay. Well, welcome to Washington. She said this is only her second time here.
Yeah,
so
thank you.
Welcome to D.C. I know I just was telling Ya in the back room that most everyone here will not have read the book, and so I am a big believer in not spoiling the book. I don't even read reviews before. I like to open a book and not even know what it's about. So I'm going to be very careful today not to reveal any spoilers, okay? Because I'm like, I told her, I said, I'm an old-fashioned reader. I read for the story, so imagine that. And so we're gonna talk about the book, but we're gonna talk about it kind of in general terms. Is that okay with y'all? Okay. But you know, I'll just say that it is phenomenal. I woke up in the morning and started it one morning, and I did not put it down until the very end. I couldn't stop reading it. So as Noma said in her introduction, this is a big epic novel spanning about 300 years. The very beginning of it starting in the 1760s in West Africa in the Ashanti region. Mm-hmm. Goes all the way through the present. It absolutely sort of connects, I felt for me, so many holes between the African slave trade and African-American culture and people today. And so for me, it was a real, I don't like to speak of novels as sort of sociological, but I did feel like it was a real education for me. But it also sort of got into my heart and my soul. I wanted to start by asking you about your inspiration for writing the novel. I heard that it was a visit to the castle. Can you tell us about that moment, and also tell us a little bit about the castle for people here who might not know?
Sure. So this novel started for me in 2009. I received a grant from Stanford University to travel to Ghana and conduct research for a novel. And I'd had kind of a different idea in mind. I wanted to write something about mothers and daughters. My own mother is a Fanti, and she's from the central region, and so I kind of wanted to visit that area. I had never been there before and kind of experience it. But that idea wasn't really panning out, and a friend came to visit, and on a whim, we decided to go to the Cape Coast Castle, which I had also never visited before. And it was pretty much instantaneous. Once I got in the castle, I knew that this was where my novel was going to take place, going to center around. It was while on the tour of this castle that the tour guide started to tell us about how sometimes the British soldiers who lived and worked in this castle would marry the local women. And then the children from these unions would be sent off to school in England, and then they kind of came back and started to form Ghana's middle class. And then from there, he took us down to see the dungeons. And, you know, there's nothing that I can really compare that experience to, kind of thinking about how there would be Ghanaian women above living with their white British husbands, maybe not completely aware of what was to become of the women below who were about to be sent on through the Middle Passage. And I was really struck by the juxtaposition of that. To talk a little bit about the castle, it's in Cape Coast in the central region, what is now the central region of Ghana. It's majestic, it's beautiful, a large white structure with cannons that face out to the sea, and there's a church and all of this stuff on the top. And it was really just the seat of British colonial power in what was then the Gold Coast. And there was a lot of trade happening in this castle, trade of all kinds, textiles and food and then slaves, which was the big business at that time. And so a lot of different people and things were passing through the castle. It's still there. You can visit it for yourself. I think I went the summer that Obama went. So we were there kind of just a week apart, maybe. And it's a really powerful place and a really powerful experience.
Yeah, you know, I've heard from people who visited that you can still feel the spirits of the people there, that it's something sort of uncanny, but the weight of that spiritual presence is still there. Did you experience that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I left thinking if there's any place in the world that's haunted, it's this, you know, how many people died down there in those dungeons. It's hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine being kept in a place that small with no light and no air and very little food. I mean, I don't know. I immediately sensed kind of a spiritual presence. Yeah.
And there is one scene early in the novel where one of the wives, the black Ghanaian wives, it wasn't Ghana yet, right? But who's married to the governor, hears someone crying or hears the sound of crying, and she gets down on the floor and puts her ear. She doesn't know that there are people under
right.
there. And she can hear the people. And when she says something to her husband about it, he shushes her violently a little bit
right.
and scares her, and she knows not to ask him again.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there was an awareness of what was going on. I'm not trying to say they didn't know what was happening. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think, you know, Ghanaians, we have these monuments to slavery all over our land, and yet we didn't get to see the result of it. You know, we didn't get to see what happened when people were sent away. And so, you know, now if you go visit the castle, I think you get that fuller picture, especially if you grow up here and have this kind of connection to the legacy of slavery that African Americans have, that Americans have.
Yeah, and what's so wonderful about you telling this story, Yah, is that there is a real focus in the early chapters of the novel on the experience of women in there, and you all can just imagine, you know, what horrors happened to the women there. Isabel Wilkerson reviewed her book for the New York Times, cover of the New York Times book review tomorrow, I think.
Yay.
Yeah, that's right, tomorrow.
Check it out. But in the very first paragraph of the review, she says she remembers her own visit with a group of scholars to the castle. And she said that they, you know, went through, and then finally the tour guide brought them to the grave of one of the governors, or
mm-hmm.
the governor. I don't know if
yeah.
there was more than one.
There were more than one.
There was more
yeah.
than one, okay. So to the grave of one of the governors, and she says one of the professors, an even-tempered professor, steps forward and spits
yeah.
on the grave. And she said the tour guide sort of hung back and allowed them to experience their grief. And I thought, you know, wow, what a moment
yeah.
to
yeah.
be there. I mean, here we are 300 years later, and yet we still feel the pain of what happened there.
Right, absolutely. I think it's hard, you know, it's hard to erase that pain, especially since so little, I think, has been done to kind of make amends for the situation. I think, you know, if you go visit, you would feel all of the rage and the grief and just, you know, just not understanding how something like this could happen on such a large scale for so many hundreds of years.
You know, I was just telling Yah, I wasn't sure if she knew this, but Roxane Gay, one of my friends and who most of us know as a really sharp writer and cultural critic, recently said that she believes your novel is the strongest case for reparations she has ever read. And I thought, wow, that's a powerful statement. But yet, while the novel has these representations of injustice and even representations of bitterness, it isn't a bitter novel. It isn't a novel that points fingers. Did you consciously think about the kinds of emotional demands you were making on the reader in terms of these injustices?
Yeah, I did. You know, I didn't want this to be a novel that kind of ascribed blame on any one party. I wanted it to kind of show the complexity of the situation. You know, people were exploiting other people. Ghanaians were exploiting other people, but they were also at the same time being exploited. And I think this is a novel where there, and a situation where there are no villains, there are no heroes. You know, it's kind of this nuanced representation of how people come to evil circumstances and how they behave in those circumstances. You know, the slave trade happened to people like us. It didn't happen to some nameless, faceless mass. It happened to people who had hopes and dreams and fears and all of those things that we have. And so when you think, how could someone do something like this, you're also thinking about yourself, you know? And so I wanted to bring that to the book.
Yeah, there's a line in there where James, he's African, but he's been named after, he's half, he's been named after his European father, he says to the village, to his village, he says, everyone was responsible. We all were, we all are. And I think that was maybe what you were getting at. Do you feel that sort of in a general sense, that when something like this happens, we all bear some responsibility?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you have to wonder, like, what would have happened if the different ethnic groups in West Africa had banded together against these European forces. You know, it's just hard. It's hard to say that any one person or any one group of people were to blame, or any one group of people were virtuous. You know, it's just this. It was a thing that was fed by greed on multiple different sides. And I think that's what James is getting at. You know, we all have this responsibility to stop this sooner than we did. Yeah.
I wanted you to talk to us, because, like I said, most of us haven't read the book yet here, about the Ashanti Kingdom. I'm really interested in the research that you did for the novel. The location of that empire was strategic. Why? And also, tell us just, like, if you can, a little bit, because the book really references a lot of history. And the American history, of course, you know, I was more familiar with. But the African chapters of the novel were new for me. And you reference, I think, the War of the Golden Stool. Mm-hmm. So can you just sort of give us a sort of abbreviated timeline of what we're talking about in this novel? We're starting in the 1660s. We go all the way up through independence. Mm-hmm. Is there any way you could do that to just help us out?
I'll try.
I know that's a big question. 300 years of Ghanaian history in 2 seconds. Go.
Let's
see. It would be helpful to just get, like, the frame.
Sure.
So and also just tell us how you did your research. We would love to hear that.
Okay. So the Ashanti live in the inland of Ghana. They're kind of in the centrally located. And they were an incredibly powerful kingdom. I think one that was feared by not just other ethnic groups in the west coast of Africa, but also by the Europeans. There were several Anglo-Ashanti wars up until the last one in 1900, which was the War of the Golden Stool, or the Ya-Santwa War, which is the war that we finally, the Ashanti, lost, and ended up being, you know, absorbed into the British colony finally.
That was 1900.
That was 1900, but they resisted that for hundreds of years and won several wars against the British before that. And so their part in the slave trade kind of centered around them, you know, kind of selling their captives from their own wars. And then the Fanti, who lived on the coast, acted as kind of a trading, location, so people would be brought down to the coast and the Fanti would sell them to the British or the Dutch or whichever European party kind of had control of that area at the time.
So they're raiding each other's villages, like, yeah. And then when they would win a raid, they would take captive some of the people of the village they had raided, and then they would sell the captives from the village they had raided to the Europeans.
Right, exactly. That's
okay.
That's kind of the basics of how that worked.
Yeah.
I went about my research. So after that trip to Ghana in 2009, I started with a book called "The Door of No Return" by William St. Clair. It came out, I think, in 2000, maybe it came out in 2009 or 2007, not too long ago. But it's a book that kind of takes you through the Cape Coast Castle. It has a chapter on the women, a chapter on the soldiers, a chapter on, you know, kind of the layout. And it really helped me wrap my head around what it might, you know, be like to live and work in the castle during that time. The unfortunate aspect of that book for me, I thought, was that it didn't have really a section from the perspective of the people who would have been kept in the dungeons. It was kind of really, you know, missing that voice. And so this novel kind of felt to me like a project in restoring that voice and kind of imagining my way into some of the people who weren't allowed to speak for themselves in that time. You know, the British brought the written language with them to Ghana, and so there were a lot of stories that were never told from our side of the line. So I started with that book, and then I wrote the first two chapters pretty much right away. And then after that, I made a family tree that I put on the wall of my apartment above my desk, and it just had either sister on either side, and then their names if I knew it, gender if I knew it, and then also the time period during which the bulk of their chapter would be taking place, and then maybe just one thing that was going on politically, historically during that time period. So the advent of cocoa farming in Ghana, or the Great Migration, or the Fugitive Slave Act, whatever it was. And so then I wrote chronologically, and once I got to a chapter, the beginning of a chapter, I would stop and do a little research about whatever it was I'd put in the background of that section. So books like The Fanti and the Transatlantic Slave Trade by Rebecca Shumway, or Black Prisoners in Their World by Mary Ellen Curtin, just enough to kind of spark my imagination. And once that had happened, I would close the book and move on. But the research, I really wanted it to feel like it was opening me up and not stifling me. So I didn't want this book to feel stiff with research. You know, I wanted you to still get a sense of the characters and the emotional aspect of the book. But
So that's really interesting that you had this sort of genealogical chart, because, you know, the book, y'all, follows two lines of a family. One line stays in Africa for the most part, mm-hmm. and the other, which comes across on one of those slaving trips. Ships. And so that brings us to, like, the structure of the book. So the book has 14, I think, point of view characters. 14?
Yes.
14 point of view characters, each in separate sections. How did you manage that, and how did you decide upon that as a structuring device?
Yeah, when I initially thought of this book, I knew that I wanted it to end in the present, and I knew that I kind of wanted it to be about the present situation. I wanted to talk about kind of the African immigrant to America and the African American. So that was my initial idea. And I thought I would just set the book in the present and then flash back to 18th century Ghana in these brief moments. And then the more I thought about it and the more I wrote, I realized that what I was much more interested in was kind of being able to look at something move and change very subtly over a very long period of time. In this case, that something was slavery and colonialism. And in order to do that and kind of have people feel, you know, the weight of that, I felt like it would make more sense to have as many pit stops in the decades between then and now as possible. So that's how I came upon the structure. It is, you know, it's not a typical structure for a book. And so, you know, it had certain challenges about how to make something cohere. Usually when you get a multi-generational family story, there aren't as many characters, first of all, and it doesn't cover as much time. And so there were certainly challenges to it, but it felt important to me that by the time you got to the present, you completely understood how and why everything was happening, you know, politically, historically, to those characters who lived in present-day America.
And did you think of it? I mean, I didn't read them as short stories, yeah. But did you think of them as individual short stories? I mean, they do all have their own narrative arc, each yeah. chapter. But did you think of them as, like, short stories?
No, I never thought of them as short stories. You know, the book always felt novelistic in scope to me, and also because I had that large timeline in mind, it always felt like very complete and holistic to me. I understand that the chapters are discrete enough that they can be read alone, and they can also be read, you know, two at a time, or however it is that, that people want to read it. But for me, the point of the book is what it all looks like together, which is why I felt like it was a novel.
I agree. I mean, as I read it, one of the things that was kind of fun is, as you began each chapter, to figure out how this character was connected to the characters you'd already given before. And typically you drop those hints about the second page, you'd start to understand the puzzle. It's the book that feels like a puzzle.
Yeah. I wanted it to feel like the kind of novel that accumulates, you know, so each generation gets a little richer. The feeling of reading it gets a little richer as you go along. And by the end of it, you know, you have this big bag full of every character that's come before.
And yeah, I'm like so in awe. I mean, it's such an ambitious structure, such an ambitious novel. Did you ever feel, as you were structuring it this way with the 14 points of view and the 14 sort of chapters, did you ever second guess yourself? Did you ever think, like, maybe I need to just scratch that and write it in a kind of traditional way? And then you couldn't because it just worked better this way?
Yeah. Well, I started it in a traditional way, and that wasn't working, so so this felt like the better option. I had written probably about 100 pages or so by the time I got to Iowa for grad school, and then I ended up throwing out all of those pages and starting on this new path with the new structure because I felt like it just suited my ideas a lot better than a traditional structure. And you know, it was the kind of thing where I couldn't tell whether or not it was going to work until I finished a first draft, which isn't like a fun position to be in as a writer. If you spend, you know, 7 years on something and then you're like, oh, well, maybe it doesn't work, so I have to throw it out. So luckily for me, it went okay when I read that first draft. But I just felt like I had to at least try it and see if it was a possibility.
7 years for the first draft, is that what you just said?
It was probably 5 years for the first draft.
Woof. How long in all did it take you to write this?
Like 6.5, 7 years in all.
Okay, so once you had that first draft, then you kind of, once you knew it was working, then you kind of were able to move forward a little more quickly.
Yeah, then I started to revise, which was a lot more fun. Yeah.
Wow, okay. 7 year first draft, y'all. Okay, and so let me ask you, so one of the things that I really loved about your, you know, expertise as a writer is that you were equally comfortable with the African scenes of the novel. Like, you had clear authority over everything Ashanti. I thought you knew the language, you knew the poetry, you knew the fables, you knew the landscape, you knew what kinds of flowers grew there, you knew what they were eating, you knew how to make fufu, you knew everything.
Yeah.
And yet then when the chapters are in the African American section, I was bracing myself. I said, can she do it? And I'm not kidding. And you had slave dialectical speech. You nailed it. You understood Baltimore culture. You know, there's Baltimore scenes there. Now, so tell us a little bit about your background. You grew up in Huntsville. You were born in Ghana. How old were you when you came here? I'm just trying to figure out everything about you.
So I was born in Ghana. I was born in Mampong, Ghana, in the Ashanti region, and lived there until I was 2.5. And then we lived in Ohio, Illinois, Tennessee, and then Alabama. Alabama when I turned 9, or the summer I turned 10, so I was 9 years old. I think, you know, I kind of grew up in between cultures, like not feeling totally Ghanaian enough for Ghanaians and also not feeling totally African American enough when I was here. And so I feel like this book really, really is just like the physical representation of me straddling those two worlds and trying to navigate those two worlds and figure out what the connections were between them and what the conversation was between us as Africans and African Americans. And so, you know, I don't think I would have written this book if I hadn't grown up in Alabama and kind of seen the way that the legacy of slavery still affects states like Alabama. And I don't think I would have written this book if I hadn't been born in Ghana and you know, experienced that side of things. So I think this book really is kind of the culmination of all of my experiences in that way.
Now, when it came to sort of slave speech and all that, did you have to, like, because people ask me how I research, I'm like, oh, I just remember how my grandmother talked.
Yeah.
Did you, I mean, I know Huntsville is definitely, you know, it's some Southern stuff going on down there. you can't get more Southern. But did you have to, like, did you get somebody to read it, check it over for you? Did you feel like you kind of had a handle on it?
I felt like I kind of had a handle on it. Yeah, just from listening, but also just reading other people's work helps a lot for that kind of thing. Because people make different choices in all of their the ways that they represent dialogue, African American vernacular, English, and in fiction. And so I kind of just tried to study all of those and pick one that felt like it worked for me. Yeah.
And you said reading other people. Who influences you?
Oh, I adore Toni Morrison. Song of Solomon was a huge inspiration for me. It was the first book by a black woman that I had ever read, and it really just turned my life around, I think. I also love Edward P. Jones. I love Lost in the City is one of my favorite short story collections. James Baldwin is a big one. I grew up Pentecostal in the South, and I just love everything that he writes about religion. Jhumpa Lahiri. I have so many heroes. Yeah.
And I just dropped a couple of my cards. I'm going to pick them up. Oh, here's a question. Early on in the novel, and I just mentioned this to her, y'all know that my first novel was Wench. And she's got a paragraph on page 19 of her novel, y'all, that just made me just drop my coffee. She'd heard the Englishmen call them wenches, not wives. Wife was a word reserved for the white women across the Atlantic. Wench was something else entirely, a word the soldiers used to keep their hands clean so that they would not get in trouble with their god, a being who himself was made up of three but who allowed men to marry only one. I always thought wench was a word that didn't apply to black women until the Americas, but you saying it was already in use over in the castle.
Yeah. I didn't know that. I mean, I knew about the marriages between the British soldiers and the local women, but I had never heard that they termed them differently until I read that book, The Door of No Return by William St. Clair, where he had looked through kind of all of this archival data about the castle and the people who lived and worked in the castle. And he had a paragraph about why they called them wenches, which was something I had never heard of before. And I thought, you know, how fascinating that there's this entire separate term for your black wife.
Wow. And to me, that, you know, one of the things I felt as I read this book was how all of our stories are so interconnected that we've all been trying to sort of piece together about the history of African Americans. But one of the things about your book is that you kind of piece it all together in one book. You know, I've been thinking of, like, how does Toni Morrison speak to Isabel Wilkerson, speaks to Ayanna Mathis, speaks to Angela Flournoy?
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I really appreciate about your book is that you piece it all together. You somehow manage to create that tapestry all in one book.
Mm.
I mean, some of the things you touch on, and I'd just like to know, you said you had on your chart significant things, but some of the things you touch on are drug addiction, migration, coal mining. Tell me about blacks in coal mining. I never knew that we had a history of being coal miners.
Yeah, this was something that came up in my research as well. In the period after the Civil War had ended, it was not uncommon to arrest black men for things like vagrancy, which is just a word that means nothing, basically. You could be standing on the street and get arrested for vagrancy. And then in certain southern states, they could sell these men to private companies, such as coal mines or railroad companies. So they would essentially, the state of Alabama would lease a man to the coal mining company for $18 a month or whatever it was. And it was the re-enslavement of black people, particularly black men, a totally legal form of re-enslavement after the Civil War had ended. And it's an aspect of our history that we very seldom talk about, but that I think, you know, considering things like mass incarceration today or the criminalization of black men today, I think we should be talking about how this system happened and how we started, we kind of started that in the period right after the Civil War.
So I, you know, when they arrest him, I think they're going to take him to a chain gang. I'd known about chain gangs, and that's right. In Morrison too.
Right.
But when they lower him into that mine, I'm kind of shocked.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then Platte City, was that a real place?
Pratt City.
Pratt
yeah.
City.
It was a real place. There's a place called Pratt City in the area that's now Birmingham. That was a kind of a coal mining town that these men had made up after they got out of the convict leasing system. And what was unique about this city was that it had whites and blacks living together, who kind of were creating this town together. But it has a really fascinating history, and one that I knew nothing about, even though I had grown up in Alabama. Yeah.
So it's this town where after they're ex-cons now, they have a hard time reintegrating into society. So they decide to just go back to the mines, mm-hmm. and they create this coal mining community where now they are working for the mines for pay, very
right.
little pay, but for pay. And it's black and white cons together,
right.
ex-cons. And they form unions. That's mm-hmm. that's all a real history.
Yeah, yeah, it's all real. There's a great book that I read for this part of the research called Black Prisoners in Their World by Mary Ellen Curtin. And she kind of talks all about what the city kind of was made of, and also just the process by which these men were arrested and leased.
Please join me in welcoming both Sid Mukherjee and Judy Woodruff.
Thank you, Brad Graham, for that very gracious. Nobody's ever introduced me before by saying good jeans.
What you have?
Except when they were talking about my blue jeans, I guess. Thank you. If you were captivated by the Emperor of All Maladies, you will be more than captivated by the gene.
Oh, thank you for saying that.
And intimate history. I feel like my mic is a little bit loud. So
I was trying to suggest that.
I'm going to speak softly. Sid, there are so many ways I'd like to begin, but I think hearing your personal story about why, after you had completed the years you had worked on the book about cancer, and as we just heard from Brad, you said you were exhausted by that, but then something else was going on in your mind about your own family, and you write about that in a way that just pulls every reader in the very beginning of the book. What happened? I mean, what was going on in your life that caused you to even think about writing this?
So, interestingly, I think I conceived of the gene. I didn't think of it as that's the name of the book, but I thought about the gene for a long time, simply because as I was growing up, I had this crisscrossing history of mental illness in my family, schizophrenia and bipolar disease in particular. I had two uncles, one with schizophrenia and one with bipolar disease. They actually died having lived with that. For many years. One of these uncles lived with my family while I was growing up, was very much part of my family. And then, sometime in my childhood, my cousin, again from my father's side, all the same side of the family, was also diagnosed and institutionalized. And that, you know, that elephant in the room, I suppose it's the right analogy for India, but that elephant in the room could not go away, would not go away. You know, like most Bengali families, my parents had elevated denial to a museum-grade art, but they couldn't deny it anymore, especially my father couldn't deny it anymore, the idea that this was very much part of his life, mental illness, and the heredity component of mental illness. And that's when we began to talk about it. So, while I was in medical school, while I was writing Emperor, while I was treating patients, all of this history, the story was constantly in the back. It was like a buzz that goes in the back of your head, you know? Am I exposed? Am I vulnerable? Who else is? What does it look like? What, you know, is there a trigger that's needed, that's missing or present, etc.? So this story was my story long before cancer was my story, or became my story. And in fact, when I finished writing Emperor of All Maladies, I thought to myself, maybe I won't write another book, I'll be done. And then I kept coming back to this idea, you know, this idea of, and as I said, it was like Star Wars, it was like a prequel to the sequel.
You dedicate the book to two people. We're going to get to one of them in a minute, but one of them was your own grandmother.
Yeah.
Because she was involved very much in taking care of your uncles who were, as you say, mentally ill. And so there's a powerful story there. There's also a story I want you to just read a little bit from the start of the book where you were with your father and you went to visit your cousin.
Yeah.
You want
to... Yeah, I'll just read a little bit from that. Just to, you know, this is where the... This is where the story really begins. So this is actually just the very first, this is the prologue of the book. It's titled Families, and it's got a little epigram. The blood of your parents is not lost in you. It's got another epigram, I'm not going to read the other epigram. In the winter of 2012, I traveled from Delhi to Calcutta to visit my cousin, Moni. My father accompanied me as a guide and companion, but he was a sullen and brooding presence, lost in a private anguish that I could only sense dimly. My father is the youngest of five brothers, and Moni is his firstborn nephew, the eldest brother's son. Since 2004, when he was 40, Moni has been confined to an institution for the mentally ill with a diagnosis of schizophrenia. He's kept densely medicated, awash in a sea of assorted antipsychotics and sedatives, and has an attendant watch, bathe, and feed him throughout the day. My father has never accepted Moni's diagnosis. Over the years, he has waged a lonely counter-campaign against the psychiatrist charged with his nephew's care, hoping to convince them that their diagnosis was somehow a colossal error or that Moni's broken psyche would somehow magically mend itself. My father has visited the institution in Calcutta twice, once without warning, hoping to see a transformed Moni living a secretly normal life behind the barred gates. But my father knew, and I knew, that there was more than just avuncular love at stake for him in these visits. Moni's not the only member of my father's family with mental illness. Of my father's four brothers, two suffered from various unravelings of the mind. Madness, it turns out, has been among the Mukherjees for at least two generations. And at least part of my father's reluctance to accept Moni's diagnosis lies in his grim recognition that some kernel of the illness might be buried, like toxic waste, in himself. So that's the first paragraph of the book.
So it's in your family. You saw it when you were growing up. You heard stories about it. As we said, your grandmother was very much an influential figure in your life, and you saw how she was toward your uncles.
Now, they came to live with us because he was no longer able to take care of himself. So in this nuclear family, growing up with the aspirations of a nuclear family in Delhi was also present, a remnant of the past because both of them had moved in with us by then.
And for you, years later, as a scientist, just the idea that in your family, you were constantly, you write, thinking about this. In your family, it was one generation and the next, but it wasn't everybody in the family. It wasn't every cousin or...
Absolutely not, yeah.
Was certainly not you. But that was the impetus that brought you to think, we need... you wanted to spend more time looking at the gene, the genetic mystery. There's a connection to cancer, the first book. But you really were embarking on a completely different and ambitious story that you wanted to tell.
And you know, I published a small excerpt from this book in The New Yorker on schizophrenia with a picture of me and my father. That was really the first thing I really wrote. I sat on it for many, many years. I didn't publish it. I didn't do anything with it. But it was the first thing that I wrote. In fact, it was the first thing that I wrote once I finished Emperor. And I wrote it privately, didn't publish it at all, didn't give it out to anyone. It was just part of my healing or writing process. And what's interesting about it, I went back to it. Now that you know you're sitting down here, I went back to it. And genetics, at least, it doesn't really rear its full head in that little thing that I wrote back then. It's about family, which is why the prologue is called Families. The idea of genetics, genes, doesn't come into it. It's a reminder that, you know, we think of this word gene, and it's suffused our culture, and it seems to be sort of an abstract concept that lies outside ourselves in science. You know, people are talking about it in laboratories. But family, genes have to do with family. It has to do with us. It has to do with how you and I are made. Who in this room doesn't have a relative who's affected by some illness, which you can ultimately track back to some interaction between genes and environment. So all of a sudden, when I look back at that little thing, it was more than probably 6 pages or 7 pages, I said to myself, you know, this is really about families. It's about ourselves as living organisms that emanate out of these things called genes. And that's sort of the conception of the book.
You wrote this, and before I ask you about, you know, some of the history here and some of the amazing figures you write about, you write this with a sense, I mean, I get a sense of real urgency from you that you felt it was important to get this down now because there's a lot going on in science, and you and I talked about this earlier today. You had a sense that it's really important for people to begin to understand themselves, not to just leave this up to the experts.
Well, let me just give you a sense of what's going on in science, and this may help us have this conversation as we move forward. We're learning to read and write the human genome. And I'm saying this very flatly because let me explain what reading and writing the human genome means. By reading, I mean that, you know, obviously all of you know that in around 2001, 2002, we obtained the sequence of the human genome. And by that I mean, well, let's first define what the genome is. A genome is the entire repository of genetic information that is in your cells, that's in an embryo, that's in human embryos, and it's written in just it's a four-alphabet code, A, C, G, and T. So your genome might read A, C, G, T, C, 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 I'm making it up, G, 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 I haven't memorized it, T, 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 C, 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 and so forth. But here's what's interesting about it. This goes on in humans for 3 billion letters. If you imagine it as written as an encyclopedia, this encyclopedia would be 66 full sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. So it would line up all the edges of this room. And if you picked up one of these 66 full sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica, it would read A, C, T, G, C, 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 T, C, C. It would be inscrutable to you and me. And yet, here's what's amazing about it. Yet, out of that seemingly inscrutable four-letter code is built you and me and everyone else in that room. It's an astonishing fact that code becomes you, becomes me. Small variations in that code are responsible in some part the difference between you and me. So, going back now to understand what the technologies allow us to do, number one is that we're beginning to read that code and beginning to, and I should emphasize very clearly, that we're beginning to be able to predict what might happen in your future for some parts of that genome. Just to give you one example, if you have the BRCA1 gene mutation, it's not 100% chance that you're going to have breast cancer, but your risk of breast cancer may be 10 times higher than the women who don't have that particular mutation. Mm. Yeah. If you have the cystic fibrosis gene mutation in both parental and from both your father and mother, the chances are nearly 100% that you'll have that disease in your future. I could tell you that when you were an embryo. If you had the Tay-Sachs disease mutation, I could tell you from your embryonic cell, I could tell you chances that you will have that disease is 100%, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's reading the genome, and now we're getting to more complicated things. I could tell you potentially more complicated things about illness. And people have started to explore, far from there yet, but people have started to explore not just illness, but I could tell you complicated things about potentially our identity. That's already entering territory that we should have some moral concerns about. That's one. And writing the genome means that not only can I do that in just reading it, I can actually go now and make directional changes, intentional changes in the human genome using a whole new set of technologies, astonishing technologies that we've hijacked from bacteria and learned to use as humans. And these technologies allow us to go into that 66-volume encyclopedia. Again, remember, 66 volumes. Pick out one volume, erase one word in that encyclopedia, and put it back in, leaving, we think, we're not sure about it yet, leaving all the other 66 volumes untouched. So it seems to me that once we've acquired these technologies, we need to talk about them. We need to talk about them. You need to learn about them. I need to learn about them. We cannot let this happen in the laboratory. Mm-hmm. Last week, there was a closed-door meeting at Harvard where they proposed synthesizing the entire human genome by stitching together single ACTGs, basically, like a little bead on a string. In other words, you could synthesize, technologies would soon become available, that you could take the entire human genome and make it from scratch. Not a science fiction fantasy. We're not there yet, but all the technologies that allow us to get there are being assembled. And this is the time to think about things. This is the time for me to think about mental illness, for you to think about whatever other illnesses and mechanisms of variation and identity that you may be interested in. This is the time to think about it. This is the time to converse about it. And if you don't, we will give this unbelievably important piece of our history and our future to people that we might not want to give it to.
And you, in the book, among other things, you write about a period not so long ago when the study of genetics was heading off in a really terrible direction, and we know it led to some pretty horrible things on this planet. But I want you to go back, though, on a little bit of the history here, because
yes.
So much of what you just described, Sid, it happened in the last 10 or 15 years, or even
maybe the last month.
But, you know, you also, you know, it's humbling to know that Aristotle was thinking about this and that the information kind of sat there. And then it was another couple of thousand years before, or almost a thousand years, before Charles Darwin started doing his work, and then after that, some other really interesting characters. And there are almost these signposts along the way of people who worked on genetics or worked on what they may not have even known was genetics, but it all came together later to be critical. Talk a little bit about some of that early work that was done. People know Charles Darwin.
Right.
But
well, let's start with, I mean, you know, what's interesting about it, and certainly we'll touch on Aristotle in a second, what's interesting about it is that, of course, this is a perennial question. I mean, since the dawn of human history, you can imagine one of the first questions we asked ourselves is, why do we look like our parents? Or why do we not look like our parents? These two simultaneous contradictions, the yin and yang, the two strands, as it were, of these questions have been part of our DNA, cultural DNA, forever. Who hasn't asked that question? When an illness strikes a family, we've asked ourselves, why did it not strike my father or my mother? Why is it mine? And so forth. I mean, variations. When two identical twins are born, we say, well, why do they look like the same? And so forth. So Aristotle had a theory about this. Aristotle really began to think about this very seriously. And it's an astonishing fact that, you know, Aristotle was an okay philosopher, but he was a very good biologist.
Which I venture to say most people didn't realize.
Yes. You know, actually, what's interesting about Aristotle, at least from reading him from my very particular tinted lenses, I see him as a biologist completely. I see him as a philosopher only secondarily. His philosophy really emanated out of his desire to taxonomize, to divide the world up in different organic forms. You know, what was formed looked like, what was... So Aristotle realized, or he made the argument, that what was really moving, what was really being transmitted across generations was a message, was some kind of message. And he has a lovely phrase. He said, it's a little bit like a carpenter shaping a piece of wood. The carpenter, when the carpenter shapes a piece of wood, he was talking about how organisms are formed, how a human being is formed. He said, when a carpenter shapes a piece of wood, he doesn't shape it by in a material way. What he does is he transmits an information, as it were, through his handiwork or her handiwork into that piece of wood. And that's what happens. He's transmitting information, a message, into that piece of wood, and that's what makes that wood piece of wood acquire whatever form. This was back in, you know, I don't remember exactly when that point of time when he writes this, but this was back in the day when people were debating about, you know, how gods gave us forms and so forth. So that's Aristotle. And then there's a long silence, really, after that. For a while, people thought, I'll give you one more highlight, and then we'll come to more modern characters. For a while, people thought that, this was the greatest one of them all. For a while, people thought that, in fact, this was so complicated. I mean, they said, how on earth can a fully formed human being, an embryo, develop out of when a woman conceives, how can that possibly happen? And they made the argument, it was an argument made in the 1600s, that in fact a tiny miniature human being was sitting inside sperm, right, wrapped up like this. In fact, they drew pictures of it too. And if you thought about it carefully, then it had to be the case that since that animal, since that homunculus, as it was called, would also generate its own children, a mini homunculus had to be sitting inside that homunculus, right? And so forth.
And so on. Infinitely.
Infinitely. Infinitely miniaturized homunculi, which was a lovely idea, of course. A little crazy if you think about it, like Russian dolls stretching out towards towards the future. But this was actually one of the most popular ideas about how we transmitted likeness, which was of course the center of the gene.
Yeah, but the information, but what he figured out or what he thought about and shared really kind of sat there, as we said, for a couple thousand years. Along comes Charles Darwin, who did some important work in all this. But then there were some others who came along who really were not appreciated at the time. One of them was a monk who you spend, I think, some really interesting pages on.
It's a fascinating story. And so that's Gregor Mendel. Gregor Mendel really launches the book and the modern history of genes. And because Mendel's a monk. Actually, it's very interesting that both Darwin and Mendel are monks. It's instructive about our times that there was a time that people with spiritual lives found no contradiction between exploring the universe in its material form as well as having spiritual lives. Someone should read Darwin and Mendel, or force people to read Darwin and Mendel. I suppose the capacity and the compassion that they brought to their, and the passion that they brought to that, to their individual scientific explorations was incredible. But Mendel, fascinating character, he was a monk, and he began sort of to do extremely simplified experiments. That was his trick. He was a great gardener. And his trick, his main insight, was to simplify this morass of ideas around genetics. You know, homunculus is sitting inside homunculus. And he said, I'm going to forget all about that in a second. And all I'm going to do is I'm going to study with almost monastic concentration. I'm going to study what happens to one or two, actually seven individual features across multiple generations of peas. Right? Here were people talking about, you know, hugely complex experiments about human embryology and how we were born. There was Mendel sitting in a small monastery at the edge of the city of Brno, where he said, all I'm going to do is I'm going to study seven characters. I'm going to map them as they move. He didn't coin the word gene. He had no idea what these things were. And at the end of it, just by mathematical reasoning, he realized that there has got to be something, that units of information, again, going back to Aristotle, units of information must be passing between the parent and the offspring.
And he was trying to understand. In fact, he wanted to work with mice, but his superiors wouldn't let him.
That's right, because mice was a little bit too risque. I mean, peas, they're far away enough from us, but mice is a little risque. I have a great, lovely story about it. So I spent some time in Mendel's monastery. It's a beautiful place. And one quick story, and we'll move on. But I went to Mendel's monastery, in Brno, and I travel. You know, you can get to it easily from Vienna, but it's a little bit of a schlep. So I traveled over to Mendel's monastery, and I arrived there, and there was a woman at the front desk, and I said, I've come all this way. I want to go and see the birthplace of biology, right? The place. It was like a pilgrimage for me. And she said, I'm sorry, you have to apply in triplicate. The monastery's closed. So I said, this is the Czech Republic. So I pleaded, I've come from all this way. All I want to do is I want to be inside. I want to see the library. And she said, no, you have to send an application. And I said, well, who do I apply to? And completely without any irony, she said, to me. And so I'm from India. And I said, two can play at this game. So I said, I hereby apply to you. With a little bow, I said, I hereby apply to you. And so she was defeated, and she let me in. She let me in. So that was my trip to Mendel's monastery. I spent about 4 or 5 days. Not in the, you can't stay there, but I spent 4 or 5 days going back and forth, being in the library, looking at that first garden where he planted those peas that generated this thing, which has now taken over the world.
And the work that he did wasn't appreciated for a long time. In fact, it sat obscure, and he was scorned. But at some point, there were a number of other important figures. Remind us, who came up with the term genetics?
So it was
somebody gets credit for that.
That's right. It was much later. Again, remember, Mendel doesn't even have that word in his vocabulary. He knows that he stumbled on something interesting. But what's amazing about Mendel is that once he's stumbled, Go ahead.
Because he fired off, once he had done this work, it was so fast, he sent his copies of his report, he condensed it, to 40-some pages.
That's right.
Sent it out to all these scholarly centers, but it was just dismissed.
Basically everyone said, what is this crazy monk writing about? And why should we be reading this stuff? And they went on describing botany and physiology and trying to figure out how embryos were formed in their very complicated ways, homunculus is falling into homunculus and so forth. God knows. But anyway, but then in the 1900s, Mendel gets rediscovered. And soon after, in 1909, we find the word gene, because botanists and biologists begin to say to themselves, we've got to have a word for this. I mean, there is this abstract. We don't know what it is. We don't know what carries it. Is it a molecule? Is it a structure in a cell? But something carries this information. Mm-hmm. We know it's important, and so we've got to have a word for it. William Bateson, one of Mendel's great defenders, I talk about him. There's a great picture of him in the book. Coins the word genetics from genus, generation, genius, all of these words coming together in that word. And so he coins the word gene or genetics, and then his colleague Johansson says, you know, that's the discipline. Genetics is the discipline. We have to name that thing, and so they name it the gene.
And the work. So it fits and starts. I mean, there's progress, and then there's a setback, and more progress. And you do an amazing, a wonderful job of bringing to life these people who really probably led pretty extraordinary lives.
Right.
They were stuck in a lab or in an office somewhere, writing and working. But then you fast forward to the 1950s to Watson and Crick. But before you get to that point, you know, things really go badly off track. Mm-hmm. Why did that happen? How did that happen?
So it's important to remember that it's important to remember that off track, because while the gene is being explored scientifically, the study of heredity, of course, has a long history. Mm. And the desire to manipulate heredity is not... there were really parallel studies. And it was in England that, coincidentally, in fact, Darwin's cousin, Francis Galton, invented the term eugenics. Galton didn't know very much about genes. Actually, he had a terrible theory of genetics himself. He made a mistake. It was kind of a homunculus, funnily enough. The mathematical homunculus, I talk about it in the book, but we'll set that aside for a second. But Galton's a fascinating character. He was a great mathematician, a great statistician, but he also lived in Darwin's shadow all his life. I call Galton, he's slung between Darwin and Mendel. I mean, can you imagine these two giants? And Galton was supposed to be an epic giant himself. He was a child prodigy and tried of course, had many important contributions to statistics and mathematics. But Galton coins this term eugenics because he thinks that regardless of what the gene is, whether there's a gene or no gene, we can use human heredity. By manipulating heredity, we can make better human beings. And Galton's proposal, he coined the word eugenics, good genes, eugenics, in order to try to make better human beings. He thought that if we breed, selectively breed the best human beings, we'll get a superior, we'll emancipate ourselves. And here's what's astonishing, which I discovered, is that this was considered an incredibly progressive idea, like taking evening walks or, you know, getting constitutional baths in spas and so forth. This was considered a very healthy idea for humankind. And many progressives, some exceptions and some notable exceptions actually, many progressives said this is a great idea, we should do more of this. And so that was Galton, and it took off in England and stayed in England. And that idea then metastasizes and reaches the shores of this country, right, where it mingles with a kind of Yankee practicality and it morphs into not just let's breed the best, let's sterilize those who carry bad genes, which ultimately sort of escalates slowly and leads to a case that many people know, Carrie Buck's case. Carrie Buck was a woman who was accused of having genetic imbecility and sterilized on that pretext. And famously, the Oliver Wendell Holmes, the so-called great judicial moderate,
right,
the case climbed to his court, and he said, three generations of imbeciles is enough. And Carrie Buck was moved to a state colony, it was called then, and she was forcibly narcotized, taken to an operating theater, and sterilized on that pretext.
And there was no real evidence that she had any mental illness
at
all.
Books have been written about it, and right, there is basically no evidence that she was a bit of a rebel. That was the worst of her sins.
And you were saying to me earlier today that you felt it was so important, and she's one of the two people you dedicate the book to. It was so important to remind everybody that this is happening, that this happened. It's not just Nazi Germany.
Yes.
Where things
And just finish up that story. Thanks for catching me. It metastasizes again and then moves from selective breeding to selective sterilization to selective extermination. Right. And that's the final incarnation. That's the final and the macabre incarnation that eugenics takes, which we now remember it by. We remember Nazi eugenics, beginning with people who had, again, mental illness, moving on to things like depression, and ultimately moving on to the racial and ethnic and human cleansing that the Nazis brought to their full macabre form. And I put that right in the middle of the book.
Right.
In fact, I wanted to start the book with that idea. But then I realized I wanted to start the book actually with the German episode. But I realized that it's much, much more chilling to watch it happen in front of your own eyes. That the road to that menace, the road to that ghastliness, was paved by progressive feet, the desire to emancipate, the desire for perfectibility, the desire to make ourselves better, ends up in less than 30 years in the extermination of someone who has a mild form of mental illness.
I think we all want to believe that that could never happen again, but as you said a moment ago, because of the incredible advances that have just been made in such a short time, that people really still don't understand. What do you think the possibility is that decisions could get made right now or in the near future that not a repetition of some of the worst of what you described, but we could head off in a direction that it might be very hard to turn around and correct?
Yeah, I'll give you two kinds of examples, and they're relevant today. I'll give you one local, so one example from the United States and one example from internationally. I personally think, having read this story, I think it's very unlikely that we will have a state-mandated form of eugenics in the United States in the future. I don't think that's likely. I think what's interesting and what's much more difficult to contend with is that we're entering an era of personalized eugenics in which we can sequence. This technology is available today. Very soon, you should be able to sequence, and people have done this already in other countries, every single gene of your unborn child. And the question you need to ask yourself is, what do we do with this information? Well, you won't know what to do with this information unless you know what genes are and how they interact with what they produce. So that's of course, one arena that it's important. But meanwhile, let's not forget that numerically the largest eugenics project is already going on in India and China. In some parts of India, there are 700 women to 1,000 men. In human history, there has never been this skew of gender ratios. That is a eugenics project. Let's not make any bones about it. That is a dysgenics project fostered by science, beginning with ultrasound diagnosis, ending up with, amniocentesis and gender diagnosis through chromosomal analysis, etc. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a dysgenic world. We're already part of it. And it has destabilized societies there. It has destabilized the way we think about it. So it's not someone else's, it's not some other world's problem. This is our world's problem. And the faster we accept it, and the more we understand it, the more armed we will be in able to mitigate against its effects internationally.
It's clearly a case of the science being ahead of where governments, policymakers are prepared to make decisions. But how much of that is a practical effect right here in the United States right now? I mean, you talked a minute ago, Sid, about the work that's being done to edit genes and what you just said about creating a person synthetically.
Creating a genome.
A genome. How much do scientists talk about that? I mean, you're a scientist yourself. How much do scientists sit around and worry about that, think about it? And how much do they talk to policymakers?
Well, they think a lot. They worry a lot about it. The policymakers don't have the language to understand what the implications are often. In fact, scientists don't have the language at all. There's an important meeting, which I describe in the book, that happens in Asilomar, the famous Asilomar conference, when actually my mentor for many years, Paul Berg, I worked with Paul for many, many years, we're still very close friends. Paul and several others, two or three other scientists, discovered the technology to cut and paste genes together in the 1970s. He won a Nobel Prize for this, and essentially it's relatively simple technology. It is, you take one piece of DNA and you cut it up using tiny molecular scissors that are made by bacteria to kill each other, and you stitch them together with another enzyme, another factor, which is used normally when your DNA strands break because of X-rays, say, something needs to stitch them back together to maintain their integrity. Mm-hmm. If you just combine these two pieces, you can suddenly start taking a gene from a frog and stitching it together with a gene from a virus. You can take two genes of any sort. And this is, of course, incredibly important technology. Cancer drugs are made this way. You take it because the genetic code is uniform and universal, you can take a gene from a blue whale and put it into a monkey or monkey cells, and the monkey cells will recognize it for all intents and purposes as if it was a monkey gene and make it as if it was a monkey gene. That's because we are all evolved from the same original organisms, and we share the same genetic code. So when this technology was first created, scientists got together and created an open meeting at Asilomar. Journalists came, bioethicists came, policymakers came. They all spent months reading. There was no document about the gene, but they all spent months thinking about, they're collecting all information that they could, learning the vocabulary. And then they had a meeting in which they said, we're going to put a voluntary moratorium for 1 year, that lasts a little bit longer, for 1 year before we can figure out what the next steps are, because this technology may unleash biological catastrophe. So it is possible, I think, at least within the United States, to put moratoria on things before we figure out what to do about them. And in fact, about 2 months ago, there was a large conference in which they suggested that there should be a moratorium on editing human genes in particular kinds of cells, certainly not every cell, but embryonic stem cells of certain kinds, although that's unlikely to happen, but certainly human embryos. Meanwhile, just to finish up, there's an experiment in China that was published where they went ahead and tried to make a defined genetic gene editing in a human embryo. And there were non-viable embryos, but they tried 76 embryos, I think, to try to make a defined genetic change.
And what happened? What was the result?
Well, the results, we don't know fully the results because it's, you know, there was published a little piecemeal, and again, there were non-viable embryos. So, but the quick answer is that in principle, they could make genetic changes in human embryos.
And what does that mean? I mean, what...
That means that in principle, you could, if you tweak the technology, you can do quite a lot of tweaking, but if you tweak the technology, you could say to yourself that I'm interested in, and I talk about how you might tweak that in the real world. The Chinese experiment is actually not a great way to do that experiment. But if you tweak the technology, you could say, I'm going to try to erase the cystic fibrosis mutation from my genetic heritage. I'm going to try to erase the or change a mutation or a variation that causes Alzheimer's disease from my heritage. And in the bizarrest scenario, you could say, I want to add information back to the human genome, which you could do. You could add information to the human genome.
We want to make people taller or something.
Again, to remind us, so, and I talk about this, it's very important to realize, tallness or height is certainly genetic, but at least 5 or 7 genes govern that. Could you change 5 or 7 genes? Maybe you can. Maybe you could change 5. At least now we're changing 1. But also, as I said, you can add information back to the human genome. That's a surprising thing. We should take that very, very, very seriously.
All right, we're going to be taking questions from all of you in just a couple of minutes. But before we do, just how do we make sure? So be thinking about your questions. But how do we make sure that this kind of work goes in the right direction and not someplace that we don't even want to think
right.
about?
Well, I think there has to be an international consensus. A national consensus won't help because the next thing you know, there's going to be an arms race. China, Korea, India will start making genetic interventions and actually outline one possibility, one kind of thought experiment. You know, there's a famous thought experiment that happened when the atom was being split. You know, long before the atomic bomb was made, there's a famous letter that Szilard and Einstein wrote saying, you know, there's no such thing as the atomic bomb, but here's a thought experiment. Just think us, walk just in your brain, walk through this process, and you land up with the unleashing of immense power in a concentrated manner. And Einstein even writes to Szilard and says, writes to the president and says, this could create a weapon of great destruction. Nothing's been made yet. It's just that you can walk the mental steps to it. So I think we need to walk those mental steps first and figure out what the realm of possibilities is. And we need to walk those mental steps internationally so that we can figure out again what the realm of controls is. And I actually suggest a kind of framework by which we can stick to before we enter an era that we don't want to enter.
So we're going to take questions, and I guess there are a couple of microphones. Before they come to the mic, Sid, you know, when I think about what you do, and I think about the book you wrote on cancer and the work you did with public television with WETA, and I should say Sharon Rockefeller here, who's the president of WETA, who worked with you on the film around The Emperor of All Maladies. And I think, how do you even have time to sleep? Because you are a scientist, you're an oncologist, you write books, you're a husband and a father, and you have a life. How do you do it all?
Well, you know, this book came out of such urgency that it had to be written. I sort of prioritized this book over everything else. It took 5.5 years. So, it seems as if it came up one morning, but it took 5.5 years. It took a lot of time, and I spent a lot of time on it. And a lot of it was going back to these stories. I thought to myself, if I can just knit together the stories one after another, I would achieve the book.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Book Store and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.